Welcome to the St Emlyn's podcast. I'm Ian Beardsall. In this episode, we're going to approach a subject that's a bit tricky and a bit difficult to talk about, but I'm really glad to have an expert with me. Liz Crowe is a phenomenon in the FOMED world, and at the recent Chicago conference, she did an excellent talk about how we approach people and talk to them about their faith when they're unwell. Liz and I, whilst at the conference, resolved that we would get together and do some podcasts talking about some of the topics she's an expert in. As I'm sure you may have heard, over the weekend, one of our close friends from SMAC died in a tragic road accident. John Hines was an exceptional member of our team and we miss him very much. And we thought that it might be an idea for Liz and I to get together and talk a little bit about how we can deal with grief when we lose somebody that we know or when we lose somebody who's a patient. We're not expecting this to be easy, so forgive us if it gets difficult, but we wanted to try and do something to help both ourselves and others deal with this tricky subject. So Liz, why don't we start off with you just telling us a little bit about yourself and the work it is that you do.
So I'm a paediatric social worker and I've worked in predominantly critical care and oncology for 20 years. And I think social work here in Australia is a little bit different from how it works perhaps in the UK. We do all of the assessments as well as the loss and grief work, the counselling. We wouldn't involve psychology or psychiatry unless there's actual psychopathology. Grief and loss, particularly under traumatic circumstances, is unfortunately predominantly the work that we do every day.
So when it comes to thinking about losing either patients or friends, we all reach out and we want to perhaps have an answer, some way that we can help ourselves. What would you say is the way that we can start to look after each other when these things happen?
The first thing I would say is that there is no such thing as normal grief. So every individual will have their own way of coping with grief. And that can be predetermined by your gender, your age, previous experience of loss and grief, how sudden it was, personality, so that there will be people who, if you're an extrovert, you might really need to be in contact with your family and friends. You might blog about it. You might journal, reach out. You get your energy and comfort from being surrounded by others. If you're an introvert, you're going to do what you normally do. You're going to be self-reflective and quiet. You might withdraw into yourself, and this would all be normal for you. I think the main thing is, particularly at the moment for the SMAC and FOMED community as we grieve John's death, is that each and every one of us is going to have our own unique style of working through this, coping, making meaning of it. One of the things that concerns me in the medical world is that most people still use a Kubler-Ross framework, the five stages of grief, in trying to predetermine how they're going to manage or what their grief might look like. Kubler-Ross contributed significantly to the loss and grief field, undoubtedly. But that theory came out in 1962, and we've really evolved since then. So I think the thing is that grief is not prescriptive. It doesn't happen in stages. You don't experience a stage and then move on and not return to previous emotions. It will be up and down, and I think that this will be unique because we can't grieve as a community together physically. Most people are having to do this via social media, and so that brings a whole new range of challenges.
So if we think about how we grieve generally before we perhaps think about ourselves specifically, perhaps the Kubler-Ross thing doesn't fit, but I know that I've experienced certain things over the last 48 hours that would fit that pattern. I've been in denial. I've tried to imagine that things haven't happened. I've got a bit angry sometimes. Is it right that we go through those stages? And when we do, how do we go about explaining that to the people around us who maybe didn't know the person that we're grieving for?
Definitely people can experience anger, denial, bargaining. Those things can all happen, but they very rarely happen as an authoritative roadmap where you think, okay, today I'm angry. That means the next phase is going to be denial. So I think the main thing is that people need to communicate as you normally would, to let family or work colleagues know that something significant has happened for you and that life is about to become harder. There's just no normal way to do it. There's no prescriptive way that I can say this is now going to be your experience and once you've had this, you're going to move on. Grief is much more fluid than that. I think each grief will be unique. So you can't say when my dog died, I did this And now that my wife has breast cancer, I'm going to do the same thing. Because each time, each grief will be unique. This is what's hard about grief is people want to know, how long am I going to feel this badly? And when is it going to stop? And when am I going to feel back in control of my life? Whereas I often say to people, when you've had a significant grief experience, it's like getting an invisible pair of glasses where the world will change from the way that you knew it. You'll have a different perspective, and that will be different for each individual.
One of the things I've found recently is that I struggle that not everybody knows that I'm struggling. So the last 48 hours have been pretty tricky, but the world's gone on around me. It's felt quite difficult to watch the world continue as if nothing's happened. To me, this was something significant. How do you keep existing in a place where, for other people, this just isn't affecting them at all? So for my work environment example, none of them knew John. I go in and say, I'm not doing so well. They say, oh, never mind. But they've got to move on. It's like when we see a patient in recess and we've got to see the next patient in minors. How do we live in that environment where not everybody knows?
You're asking some really difficult questions, I'd have to say, because I don't have a prescriptive answer. But I think the main thing is about being acutely aware of yourself. So if your grief is really pronounced and it's really impacting the way that you're able to engage with other individuals, the way you're able to work, then you might need to have some self-awareness to say, you know what, today I can't work in trauma. Or can I swap a clinical day with a non-clinical today because I actually don't feel safe to work in this environment. I feel quite emotive and unable to tap into the more cognitive higher functions of myself. So that would be the first thing. The second thing is that I think lots of medical people in particular are quite good at compartmentalizing. Grief can be going on for people. And they can compartmentalize that and say, this grief isn't going to stop, but at the moment I'm going to put it to one side while I get on with the tasks at hand, and then know that in the safety of the shower or when I'm driving home tonight, that I can be emotional and really reconnect with my grief in a way that allows me to keep working. But that's not always able to be the case. So you've got to have good self-awareness around your own grief and how you deal with things so that you're able to support yourself individually when sometimes others can't be aware.
So at SMAC, ironically, before John's death, I actually did a talk about grief, and this was talking about grieving for a patient where I wondered whether I'd done enough for the patient. And actually it's on another podcast on the St. Emmeline's feed that people can listen to if they'd like to. SMAC's very good at talking about how we feel. And that idea of compartmentalizing those feelings. For many people, putting a brave face on it is what we do. I worry that that actually can be quite harmful, and that actually then when you're in the shower, it becomes uncontrollable. How can you control when the box that you've put these feelings in opens? Is there a way of planning to do that? Is there a way to distract yourself from just how terrible the things are that we see and we experience?
So I was saying, if you have to compartmentalize for a small period of time, be aware that that's what you're doing and that the grief is going to be sitting there waiting for you on your return. What we know from the literature is that people who compartmentalize and put something in a box and don't go back and revisit actually do quite poorly from a mental health perspective, because you can't continually put something to the side when it's very painful or when it needs addressing. It will just sit there and fester, and at some stage it will come back. If you need to compartmentalize just simply because you've got to work or you've got a parent or you're in an environment where people have no idea or you don't want to share because of privacy, you have to know that you're going to need to return to that and work through it. The very clear thing that's coming through in my PhD on staff wellbeing is that the people who do the best are the people who are able to really self-reflect. Be aware of what it is that they require for themselves and seek out help, supervision, counselling, mates, whatever the situation is that works for them, to actually get to the bottom of things and understand what their own psychological needs are. They're the people who do the best. When I said compartmentalise, I meant you can put it to the side for a moment, but you must return to it because at some point it will manifest. And for some people that comes up physically, for some people that it really is the emotion overwhelms them. People get to a point where they think, I'm going to control my own emotions. And we can to some extent, but sometimes grief is really about losing control. Sometimes grief is just completely overwhelming. It was C.S. Lewis that said, "Nobody told me that grief was so much like fear." And there is a very strong connection between fear and grief. And I think for the SMAC community and the FOMED community, there will be some of those strong connections. First of all, when you grieve, you feel really out of control. You fear that the emotions aren't going to be able to be suppressed. You fear that you're not going to be able to live the life that you had before. You feel that you're never going to be happy again. When you look at someone like Dr. John Hines, who was this massive personality, this wonderful mentoring presence in people's lives, who seemed larger than life itself, his death also brings a whole range of fears about mortality. If someone as amazing and alive as John can suddenly be gone, then we all can be gone. And I think that's really confronting.
That's one of the things I found particularly difficult, I think, was John, as I'm sure many people know, was a motorcycle doctor and would be there at road races in Ireland, especially following these motorcyclists at 150 miles an hour to make sure that if they came off, he would look after them. And he told us stories called Cases from the Races, where he would show videos of people coming off and he would describe the incredible treatment he'd give them in a very humble way. And I never thought that he could end up being a patient. I just didn't consider that it would ever be possible. I found that incredibly confronting. I thought he was invincible, not because he was big-headed or arrogant or he just seemed that this would never get him. I've always been quite fearful of my mortality, but this has made it even more acute for me. And I'm guessing that's how other people feel as well.
I think most of us harbour this belief, whether or not we're aware of it, that if you work in this area, if you are present for enough resuscitations and traumas and deaths, it's going to in some way protect us from it ever coming into our own sphere of life, friendships, impacting our own health. John's death has showed us that that's not true. We can do all of this and be good people and make significant contributions to the world, and we can still die. And that's really confronting. The time frame in which this has happened for people will escalate that, because you can see from the Twitter feeds that people are saying, 10 days ago we were drinking, or I shared a cab, or went and shook his hand because I was amazed by him and felt that he'd taught me something, or I was aspiring to be him and now he's gone. And that's devastating. It feels like the world has lost someone very amazing, but it also feels like our own mortality is now right at the front door.
I think people must face their mortality in different ways. I know that some people seem incredibly at ease with the idea that one day they'll die. I'm sure for others, it's more of a fear. I can't actually imagine that anyone doesn't have a little bit of fear about it. What do you say to people when you try and counsel them about what is the only inevitable thing in life, which is that one day they will die?
It's really difficult because everyone will have such a unique story. So for me, if I was going to die, my major fear would be about my children. It wouldn't be about myself. And at different life phases, there would be different things that you'd be concerned about. Lots of people really fear pain or suffering at the end, and that becomes really pronounced. But really, death is hard on the people who stay behind. That's the reality. The pain is for people who have to stay behind and learn to negotiate a world without that individual in it. And it's the undoing. It's the longing. It's the breaking the habits. It's not being able to contact John now or ask his opinion of things, or thinking forward to SMAC 2016 and knowing he's not going to be there. That's the pain. The way that our brains work is that denial, if you want to use a Kubler-Ross term, is actually very healthy. No one wants to fully embrace what this actually means all in one hit. Our brain will do it in a very slow and controlled way often. And there might be times when you become overwhelmed, but there will also be times when you'll forget that you're sick, or that your loved one has left you, or that John has died. It's not denial in the sense that you're working hard to believe that's not true. That's just your brain's way of easing you into a new life where that loss is going to be pronounced.
So we're all dealing with these different things at different times. And for those of us who were at SMAC and knew John, it's especially pronounced at the moment. Have you got any ideas about how you can help move through it? I understand that grief is different for everybody, and depending on your personality may change how you want to deal with things. But are there ways in which this can help? So does it help to write things down? Does it help to be active? Does it help to want to do something? Is this very personal, or are there certain things that we know may help get us through these hard times?
I don't think you move through grief. I think you learn to integrate it into your life. So a bereaved mother once said to me that for her, the grief was like a terrible, horrendous burn. In the early hours, days, weeks, months, it just burnt all the time. It woke her in her sleep. It was present physically and emotionally for her 24 hours a day. So even in restful times, she woke with pain. And then she said over months, and the time frame will be different for everyone, but over months, it became like a painful wound. There were short, brief periods of time where she could cope and she could function without it just being completely overwhelming and powerful. But if she found one of her children's socks, if she smelt something that was associated with that child, it was like someone tore the scab off the wound and it was extremely painful again, like as bad as the first hours and days. And then over time, the wound gets a bit more robust and it can be carried around and it can even be bumped and it'll still hurt, but you can keep functioning. And she said, you know, years later, it's a scar and it still hurts. And there are times when she has to sit and really mourn and cry and grieve and ask why. But there are also periods of time where it's really manageable. And I think that's what grief is like. It doesn't matter if it's a divorce, a miscarriage, a loss of a really treasured friend or mentor, is that you're not going to move through it. You're just going to have to find a way to integrate it into your life. And we do know that there isn't a prescriptive way. So there will be people that journaling, exercise, painting or meditation might be particularly effective for. For lots of people, they're just going to have to experience it. And that's hard. And it hurts. And people don't like to feel pain. And people don't like to feel out of control. But that's what grief is. Grief can really manifest very physically. Pain to the heart, throat, gastro, headaches, ulcers, panic attacks. That's all can be part of grief. In saying that, can I just say that the amount of parents, even very young parents that we see that genuinely have a cardiac experience, including cardiac arrest when their child dies, is around about 10%. So if you do have chest pain, it actually is really worth getting checked out. So I think what we're seeing with John is a lot of people are trying to make some meaning or sense of his death by having this passion to drive the HEM service in Northern Ireland. For some people, being very active, or what we call instrumental in their grief, and that means actually doing something that feels like they're moving things on or making meaning from it, can be very powerful. In the literature, it says about 85% of people need to make meaning of the situation, and then there's about 10% who don't need to do that at all, and they're very practical and pragmatic about it. And then there's about 5% who are at huge risk because they want to find meaning and they can't.
I guess one of the things we need to guard against as our community, and whether this is the SMAC community about John, or if this is somebody else dying and unrelated to this, or perhaps even if people are seeing these traumatic things at work, how do we identify the 5% and what can we do to look after them? How do we know if that's even us? Perhaps it's one of us who's the 5%. Where can we go to get help, or how can we identify that people need help?
Grief is not depression, and I find it extremely distressing when we have someone who has had a child die and within 3 or 4 days they're on antidepressants because they're not depressed. That's actually grief. Grief can become depression over a period of time. How you differentiate what is depression and what is grief is quite difficult because grief, particularly in the early stages, and that can go on for months, has some very similar components to depression. the world can seem completely black and grey. There is nothing that seems to be positive, that people can't work out how they're going to negotiate the future, where people feel a huge sense of helplessness, where things don't make any sense. At the moment, if people are feeling really overwhelmed, it would be good to confide in someone. They don't necessarily have to engage in therapy or counselling, but just to go and talk to someone and say, I feel really overwhelmed and distressed by this. If we're going to be very stereotypical, men in particular can really struggle during times of grief because women, stereotypically, have been brought up very strong communicators. Like if you look at children in play, girls are often really attracted to things that practice talking, practice sharing emotions, practice asking how people are feeling. So even if it's dress ups, it's like, you look really beautiful. Do you like how this looks on me? And girls get practiced at responding to that. Whereas boys are often much more action based. They don't tend to communicate. They don't tend to practice talking and checking in with one another. You can be an adult in your 40s and have your first significant grief experience, whether it's a relationship breakup, a friend dying, an illness in the family, and just not have the practice skills about unpacking that. And that can feel exceptionally overwhelming. Tears are really confronting for people who don't cry very often. It can feel like you've snapped. Whereas in actual fact, it can just be an expression of emotion and it doesn't need to be overanalyzed. There is some research that hasn't been repeated, so I'm not saying it's been a randomized controlled study for those people who like that sort of research, where they're saying that for some men, once you hit puberty and you get a rise in your testosterone, it can actually block the hormone that creates tears. So that may be part of the reason why we see little boys cry. Once they hit puberty, they don't cry. And then we see men as they get older cry again. Now, there is also a whole realm of sociological reasons why we may not see men cry, because they don't want to appear weak and they get negative feedback from the community. And I'm also not suggesting that men who cry aren't great studs and have huge amounts of testosterone. I'm not saying that. But I'm saying sometimes men will say, I feel like crying and nothing's happening. And very well-intentioned women in their lives will say, you're not trying hard enough. And that's ridiculous. Every person will grieve in their own way. We don't have to look for tears to know that people are grieving. A man's style of grief is as valid as any other. So I don't think we need to be looking for tears at the moment to see people grieving. It can come and manifest in a whole range of ways. So if people's sleep patterns are disturbed, if you don't feel like overwhelmed and overstimulated by the world, that can be grief. It's really about connecting with yourself and being really self-aware. And if you're noticing that a colleague or someone in the SMAC community seems to be a bit more withdrawn, just checking in, saying, this is what's happened for me. And I think what was really powerful about your talk in at SMAC was you were able to be vulnerable. Tim also did a great talk on vulnerability. Grief can bring new experiences for us that can feel really overwhelming, where we can feel vulnerable. And if we can share that with others and help unpack that, then I think that's the first step. So having some insight into your own emotions is the first step to good well-being.
And crying's okay?
Crying is absolutely okay. For lots of people, it can be a new experience, particularly for men. Lots of people who work in the trauma environment think, I shouldn't cry because I see this all the time. Or what if now that I've cried about John, I'm now going to cry everywhere? We do know that when people have a personal crisis, our work will become a lot harder and we will be more vulnerable and we will be more susceptible to emotion. So at the moment, if you're grieving John and then you do a resuscitation and a family is very emotional and you feel yourself well up, that doesn't mean that now this is what you're going to do for the rest of your life. But if it means that maybe you are going to start welling up more frequently, families report that to see health professionals become emotional is of an enormous comfort and helps them to connect with the healthcare professionals much more quickly. I don't think it's something that we need to be afraid of.
Liz, there's so much more that I hope we get to talk about. We really have only scratched the surface of what's a really complex topic. But from what I think you're saying is that grieving is okay. There's no particular path that anybody's going to take, but we need to try and be open, and we need to try and talk if we can. And we need to keep an eye on people who aren't talking. And if during those conversations we cry, then that's all right too. But we don't really know how this is going to go for us. It could take a long time. It may get better sooner. But the key thing is to be together and to share those experiences when we can.
Grief is a really natural part of life, just like happiness is a natural part of life. To accept that and maybe to sit with it in the quiet, sit in the rubble with that, as difficult as it is okay. But if we know someone who's grieving, we can't necessarily fix it. But to say I'm present and I'm here is very powerful in itself.
I guess, Liz, when we started talking earlier, I wanted you to give me the answer. I wanted you to give us all the answer as to how we deal with this, about how we make something that is frankly awful better. The thing I think you're saying is that there isn't an easy answer. It won't necessarily get better. But the only way to get through this is to go through that pain, do it together if you can, and find your own path.
There is no quick fix for this, and there's no one simple answer. And there could be people in our community saying, look, I did this and it worked really well and now I feel in a better space. And then there will be others who will grieve forever. We'll see an outpouring of grief in 2016 and SMAC, when it'll be the first time our community is back together, when it becomes a very strong reality that John Hines isn't with us. And that can happen in any sort of grief, where you can sort of park it to the side because the reality is not in our faces. I would just say to people, move really gently with yourselves at the moment, take care, and reach out. If you're concerned, reach out. And know that grief is painful, and unfortunately, it's the cost and consequences of love and caring or being heavily attached to things.
Liz, thank you so much for taking the time to talk. I'm hopeful that we can persuade you to do more with St. Emlyn's on the podcast and the blog, because I'm sure what you have to offer us all is incredibly valuable. This isn't just a podcast for people who knew John. This is hopefully for people, whoever you are and whatever you might experience, to just try and help a little bit. And I guess what we're trying to do is to do what Liz has said. We're trying to do something to help. And if we can do anything, and you want to talk about it or anything like that, of course, social media has been a great way that we can share these experiences. And perhaps without social media, we never would have had this closeness of a community. So we hope that you found this podcast useful, and we look forward to speaking to you again soon. Please take care.